Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 66, titled, Do We Need to Believe in Past and Future Lives to Become Enlightened?
Okay, now to the task at hand. I have a very short talk. No, you can't get enlightened if you don't think there's a former and future life. That's all, very simple. You know, you don't even qualify as a religious person, according to Atisha, Dongkhapa, everyone. Because you're so delusional, and even, but really, you're fine, though, you know. If you don't have a former and future life, you know, you don't need to get enlightened, because you don't exist. You know? And that's what you're told from Harvard, MIT, Columbia University, all the great sages, Oxford, Richard Dawkins, Carl Sagan, they all tell you that you don't exist. And you don't know that you don't exist because you live as a deluded person running around thinking you exist. And you find out when you die. You return to your natural state, which is non-existence. And this is all settled. No problem. But anybody who tries to pretend that that's what Buddha thought is just completely cracked. It's psychotic. It's not even sane. And why? I just want to tell you right away, get to the main point of the matter. Now, you probably, actually, how many of you here think you're going to have a future life? I know you're just putting me on. I know. If you think you don't know, then that's good too. You know, some people think enlightenment is to don't know. They go around, don't know mine. So therefore, the Buddha, when he was like enlightened under the tree, he should have gone, duh. Please. I mean, how can we bring things down to this level? It's really sad. My point is this. You've all talked, therefore a lot of you do think that, so you've all had conversations with neighbors and friends, and you said something about future life, you know, former life, you know. And they say to you right away, looking very condescending, they say, what is your evidence? And you say, well, a lot of people remember previous lives, continuity is the rule of nature, you know, there's people on TV who get instructions on how to feed the cat from recently departed people, and they tell the where the cat food is hidden. And, I mean, there's, like, a lot of evidence, you know. That's just anecdotal. That's anecdotal. That's meaningless. And then you can tell them, well, meaningless anecdotal evidence will send people to the electric chair. So I don't think it's meaningless. I think it's powerful. But, okay, you say it's not scientific. And you go on like that sort of defensively, and you invite them to look at the evidence, read Ian Stevenson's work, or look at the ancient books of all kind of religions, not just Buddhism, and, you know, actually go back and realize that up until the time of Constantine in the Mediterranean, metempsychosis was common knowledge. In Jesus' time, everybody was getting reborn like mad, you know. They were all arguing over which rabbi was what, you know. And the Tibetans have overdone it so much that there is one famous geshe. Not famous, but he was Jambal Tagya Ganden Geshe, who we had. He used to be at University of Virginia, who was very wonderful and kind and wise. And at one time, his disciples were feeling devotional. And they said to him, Geshe-la, you're so kind and you're so concentrated and you're such a great yogi and a knowledgeable teacher and really wonderful. How come you're not a reincarnation? And he said, well, I always wanted to be, but all the good ones were taken. I think it's very, very good about Tibet. You know, they're all, everybody's reincarnation. So anyway, they ask you this and they get all snobby and then they wander along their way, you know, and they collect their grants and they act like they know what's going on. And then, it took me 40 years to overcome the sense of intimidation and ask them.
Can you turn
it's not working?
The headset.
What's the matter?
Can you turn the headset on?
Oh, it's not turned on. Oh. Oh, that's great. Oh, thank you. Is it more turned on now? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So then it took me 40 years or 30 years to say, like, okay, that you're not going to exist after you die. What is your evidence? Stop to think about it. And then, first time I thought of that, I said, did Carl Sagan show up and say, hey guys, it's cool, I don't exist. You can be sure now, I'm really sure. I can testify, I don't exist. Did that happen? Actually, could that happen if that were the case? In fact, in principle, there will never be evidence of non-existence, right? Nobody will ever discover non-existence. It doesn't exist. It's not there. Nobody can get into it. Nothing ever goes there. Nothing comes from there. Non-existence means it's nothing. So you can't be nothing. It's impossible. There'll never be proof. Therefore, you can leave your conversation partner in this particular conversation with the fact that is plain in their face that their belief that they will not have a future life is nothing but blind faith without any evidence. You get it? Is anybody refuting that? Any argument on that? They propose as a dogmatic blind faith article of faith that you have to be a natural scientist. You cannot get tenure in the United States unless you believe that and subscribe to it. And they are scientists looking for evidence and reason, and there's no evidence and no reason, and that's their article of faith. Is that scientific? It's insane, actually. They believe that that nothing is a discovery, and they've discovered it. And they won the Nobel Prize for that. I discovered nothing. But I won a prize. And I assure you, you're all going to be nothing. What is that? Is that sanity? That's the basis of our elite worldview of this culture, of this planet. These are the people who are destroying it. Okay? Climate change. Oh, no, we can't turn it off. We need a lot more light in Times Square of Las Vegas. So we need more power, more energy. We need that. So, yeah, we need subsidies from poor people in the oil industry. They need a $1 trillion subsidy every year. On this planet, all those guys in Paris signing these documents, we're not going to, like, destroy the planet. By 2030, we'll do something. By 2040, we'll do something. After the Greenland ice comes and, like, rolls down Main Street Portland. We'll do something, they say. And then they are giving, Russians, Americans, Chinese, they're giving over $1 trillion of subsidy to burn more carbon fuel. Not only are people paying it and paying for it, but the governments are giving subsidies of over $1 trillion. And nobody can do anything about it. Oh, no. Why? Because they're a bunch of insane psychotics who think they discovered nothing and they are going to be nothing. Do you realize that? Okay? You got that? And then there's one or two of them who purport to be teaching about Buddhism and say that that's what Buddha taught. What do we do with that? What can you say? It's like breathtaking. Buddha said you don't exist? Then why did anybody listen to him? Someone gets up, I don't exist. Eureka. Well, then other people should walk out. If you don't exist, why are you talking? What's the problem? So it isn't really, can you get enlightened without former and future life? It's really, why would you bother? Just shoot yourself. And you're back to your reality, which is non-existence. Just stop your brain, that's all. It's too much trouble to carry this brain around. It weighs many pounds. It, like, burns up a lot of heat, dehydrates you. Why bother? Just shoot yourself. Then you just don't exist. And, you know, it kind of grits your teeth. Bang! And then you're simply not there. And you never knew you were there, so nobody's regretting. Right? And some people will regret that you went, and then they won't exist, and they won't regret it. So destroy the whole planet. Why not? Who cares? It's all non-existent. Do you follow me? This is a bunch of psychos on this planet. You know, Tony Perkins with a knife running around in the showers, chasing someone. We have to face that. It's nice to be polite. Oh, let's talk to them. Oh, they're so brilliant. They make hydrogen bombs. They must be smart. They drop them. Even. They give the trigger to, like, you know, psychological giants like W or Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin. I mean, you know, we have to face where we are, which means that those who have a little sense about it have to be vigorous in pursuing the positive, right? Because obviously, without a miracle, there's no way of moving along. And therefore, in a political revolution that Mr. Bernie is calling for, everybody's Jewish uncle from Brooklyn, he's calling for a political revolution, but that's to forestall a real revolution, a violent one, which will come if they continue to behave like this. Okay? So that's the main thesis. So that's it. Then we can pack up and go and take a break. You get it? Anybody questioning that? Nothing doesn't exist. It's a non-referring word. If you ask somebody, you can. I've done this in large audiences around the country, and I said, how many people here are afraid of nothing? A lot of people go like that. And then I say to them, it's a little trick, you know. I don't need to do it with you all, because you all are properly paranoid about your future life, and you want to be sure it's not in a bad situation. You would rather prefer to be reborn in Oregon, where you have a chance to vote. Yeah. And where you have a beautiful green valley, and you're not being persecuted by, like, Alec, or the Koch brothers, or, you know, they're insane people. You know, more insane people. So you'd like to know that. And you're worried, you know, and you don't want to watch too much TV about, you know, Georgia or something, because you might get hypnotized by some place there and then die and be reborn in Georgia. Or in Alabama or something. Right? So you're all nervous, and you're all, you know there's a consequence to what you think, what you do, and what you say. So therefore, you're already cool, you know. You're already cool. You don't think that you're nothing. You don't think the excuse that you're nothing. But unfortunately, you know, we although we consciously have that belief, we are brought up in science, not in churches and synagogues and things, but in science classes, in our education. And we are brought up with a sort of feeling that really what's real is just the matter around us. And these things about the future life, well, maybe, maybe not. Some people go around and don't say, I'm an agnostic, I don't really know. Doesn't matter if you don't really know. The point is, if you're nothing, you know, you're not going to regret if you are paranoid and you make an effort to book your future life. Like, if you go somewhere on an airplane, you book your hotel room. You book your destination. You take your passport. You make preparations. You don't mess around because you don't want to land somewhere and have to sleep in the street. Right? So, we're all going somewhere. We're all going to die. Right? You know that. That's not rude in a Buddhist center to say. Because everybody here is meditated, right? You know, there's your negatse la lome pa. Yaryam sabne se di na se dok. How many of you know that by heart? Jaya Ruches, Tongkapas, you know, three principles of the path. Devzor Nyega. It's very hard to find this human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, or whatever people, however they really want to translate it, right? And there is no time in life. Think of those things again and again, and you will turn off, you will reverse your obsession with this life. That's the foundation of the path. Right? That means, right? You all know that. Everybody know that one? Have you all meditated on that? Yeah? Devzor Nyeka? Do you realize how valuable you are, everyone? You do? Do you think that your time, therefore, is as valuable as Warren Buffett's, who in a minute could lose $1 billion if he's not alert? Do you think your time is like that, or do you wait for things? Do you pass the time? Do you sort of, you know, spend your time? Do you think it's valuable like that? If you feel that your body and your brain and your mind is so valuable because you are this beautiful human being that you are, if you feel that, you're not going to waste your time. You might even go down to Maitreepa to listen to some overworked and somewhat hoarse person from New York. Tell you what you already know, hopefully, but
This is the thing about that meditation about the preciousness of human life, where the path begins. The reason people don't use their life, you know, and by the way, Buddhism is not mainly meditation. Do you know the Eightfold Path? What is the first branch of the Eightfold Path? The first one. Is it meditation? Is it mindfulness? No. Why not? If that's the main thing. The first branch is realistic worldview. Right? Yandak Bitawa, Samyak Drishti, which I learned from Alan Wallace, is better translated as realistic than right. Right is not good because right is like following the rule. I'm right, you're wrong. It's not a matter of being right according to some prescription. It's a matter of being realistic according to reality. Samyak means, you know. It's Sanskrit. It's not about some yak. This man here is a yak. So he just took off his horns.
I'm hoping you're helping with that.
For the moment. So, but the thing is, when you meditate on a theme like that, let me tell a story. My guru, my original guru, was a Mongolian gentleman named Geshe Wangyal. And he used to, he was a clairvoyant person, very enlightened person, and a geshe from Drebung, Gomang. But he had clairvoyance. And when I would go meditate in my early years of study, which I was dying to do, because I was frightened of life, and I was trying to get away from it as much as I could, and I especially liked meditations where I had like that lifting feeling, and I sort of got away from my body, and I was hoping to get away from it permanently and everything else. And that guy had radar, and at 3 a.m. in a bush out behind the monastery, they had to come meditate, and he would show up and say, "Oh, you can't plant at night, it's dark. What are you doing? Are you weeding the bush? Get out of here, let's go have yoga." And this one time I was already, I had been studying a couple of years, 3 or 4 years, I thought I was really like, I was meditating, I sneaked out 3 a.m. in the temple, and I was like meditating, I had a candle, you know, I was there, like people, switches up the light and think, "What are you doing? What do you mean, what am I doing? I'm a Buddhist monk, I'm meditating. Why are you meditating? What do you mean, why am I meditating? I'm a Buddhist monk, I want to get enlightened." He said, "Oh," he said, "You can't get enlightened, you're an American." I said, "What do you mean? I mean, I'm an American now, I'm like a Buddhist monk, and I'm a shaved head." You know, little did I know, years later, my daughter would say that I looked like Henry Miller in drag. But anyway, I was very gung-ho. I said, "You're American." I said, "What do you mean I'm American? I don't have American attitudes. I believe in forming my future life." He says, No. "You're an American, and when you to get enlightened, you have to have a mind. And you Americans don't think you have a mind." He said, and then I argued violently, and we went on for days and weeks about arguing. And of course, he was absolutely right. So when you meditate on your belief in your former and future life, the way you do it is you combine shamatha and vipassana. You know, you don't just meditate and sit there, future life, future life, future life, precious, precious, precious. You don't do that. You do think that and focus on evaluating the value of your evolutionary moment as a precious human being, and among human beings, one with liberty and opportunity to the teaching of enlightenment, to how to become, how to change yourself and transform yourself into the butterfly of an enlightened being. So you do think that, but you also be passionate. You look into yourself and you look and find those attitudes which we believe that our mind is not over matter. You know, it's like the person who is like, you know, eating organic food and taking Chinese medicine and doing this and that, and then they get a little sick and they rush to the hospital. And they get chemotherapy and they get all this stuff meanwhile, and they get killed by our ridiculous medical system, which is a business, actually, and it's not a healing profession, really, except for the very few people who manage to get through the boot camp of medical school, bonding with their guild, instead of like really developing their compassion to basically really try to take care of people. So unfortunately, it's what's happened in our country, because we're really in worse shape than we were when he told me that. So in other words, you meditate that you kind of don't really have the confidence of your own mind. You try to find where is that lack of confidence, because realize this elite that is telling us that we're nothing at death,
like acting like, you know, Daniel Dennett, you know, Richard Dawkins. I mean, these guys are like, we got Oxford, you know, British accent, you know. You know, these guys are like really arrogant. And they tell us with strong conviction, and it's like a guy with a white coat, and you have to believe that, you know. From childhood, they're like high priests. They're like high priests. And actually, even they in the universities, they are the natural scientists. They're the high priest side. And the psychologists, the way they show how important they are is they sacrifice animals. They make ritual sacrifices. Slice the brain and watch for that die and join. That's going to help me and make you enlightened. I'm going to get a drug out of that. You take it and you'll be the Prozac down. And you won't even mind. And you'll be fine until you die, and then you're really fine because you won't exist. I mean, that's the kind of system we're in, you have to realize. And that is in us. It's in our minds. And we don't really believe. You know, we watch The Matrix, and we see Neo look at the little boy bending the spoon in that scene when he's going to see the Oracle. And it's like fantasy. You know? Nobody believes that. The mind is over matter. And I'm very frustrated myself. After 50 years of studying Buddhism, and I can't levitate still. No, I'm really frustrated. Because that way, well, that would be a good way to win a debate. Of course, they'd probably arrest you and dissect you. Which is maybe why we can't do that. But we should be doing miracles. And actually, according to the environmental scientists, we have to do some miracles in the next decade or two, or we're doomed. You know, our grandchildren at least are doomed. Maybe we can sneak in and think, oh, I won't be here, like George Bush said. But actually, we will, because we'll be reborn here as the Greenland ice cap comes crashing down. Main Street. Seriously. So I particularly don't like people who claim to be teaching Buddhism. We have modern Buddhism. We don't need former or future life. I think it's really misleading, and it's very, very unfair to the population that needs to hear about this, you know. And it isn't a religious thing. And they pretend that the reason they're so brave and they don't do that, I'm like Sam Harris. I'm against religion, but I'm still a Buddhist. Of course they can call themselves a Buddhist, but, you know, they're not really Buddhists because they don't exist. They are going around acting like they don't exist so they can do whatever. What you realize, if you don't, what's wrong with a psycho? A psycho thinks, psychopath, sociopath, they think that there's no consequence of what they do. They're not really present to their own actions. That makes them reckless and irresponsible. And it's like our whole culture is reckless and irresponsible. We don't turn off, and then we act like, oh, there's nothing we can do about it. Have you studied the recent history of Germany? Angela Merkel, who is some kind of green Tara, you know, she's a real green Tara, Angela Merkel. She brought Dalai Lama right in the chancellor's house, and their Chinese were having a bird outside, you know. And she brought him right in. She's so great. Her own foreign minister was ready to go to China and draw salary from them and have her busted as chancellor. Well, she saw Fukushima. She turned off every nuke in Germany just like that. And then she switched the subsidy from the fossil fuel industry just like that and gave it to distributed, you know, solar panels. And within 10 years, less than 5 years, there was cheap electricity all over the place, so much so that the stocks of the centralized utilities burning their coal and fuels of different kinds went down through the toilet. So then they were all upset and said, this is a disaster. So our culture is so sick that it's a disaster for people to have cheap, free, and non-polluting electricity. That's a disaster. Because it doesn't fit their model of their elite that makes money out of the destructive system. Do you realize that? So we could do that here. We could do that here. But you know what? The Koch brothers have assured that you can't put solar panels on your house in Arizona, Nevada, or Florida. No, you pay a penalty. You have to pay because they've made fake populist, seemingly populist resolutions saying that you're free riding on the people who are paying too much to the utilities because they made a stupid nuke that they had to put away and you have to pay for it. And so then they pass the legislation and then they have people in the legislature that they own. They have a bunch of political serfs that they own that are making laws like that. So you can't even buy it cheap. Instead of subsidizing you, they're doubly and triply subsidizing the nasty people who are wrecking the planet. You get it? Why is there for one Vermont dropout Jewish guy from Brooklyn saying we need a political revolution? Why is he talking that? Because we're in the grip of these fascists, actually. I'm sorry. I know that, but this has to do. I know some of you are elder, and therefore this will affect your future life. Because you'll be reborn somewhere underneath one of the David Koch pumping machines, and the pollution will go down when you're in the womb, and you'll grow up with three eyes and an extra ear, and I don't know what, like in China. So you're not getting out of the consequence of this, so you need to stand up and make a revolution. Okay? Even if you're elder, you can't still thinking, well, now, gee, my grandkid, I'm so sorry, but I won't be there. Like everybody is doing, and letting this thing go on, this charade go on. So that's the thing, you know. Maybe I should stop, you know. I don't know. I'm not running for office myself, but I probably should. So that's the thing, that you really need this former and future life. And the former and future life is not a... back on topic. Former and future life is not a blind faith thing. It's an empirical thing. It's a scientific claim. Now, the Buddhism has a wonderful disclaimer about all scientific theories, which fits very well with Karl Popper's idea that all seeming theories are hypotheses based on previous experience and data and so on, and awaiting falsification and modification and paradigm shift based on more data and more experience. And there is no absolute law about the nature of the relative world. Buddhism has the same hermeneutical principle that they proclaimed, finally they caught up with it in 1926 in Copenhagen. It would be Denmark that they'd catch up with Buddha in India. No, they just caught up. They're backward, because we're backward. The Western society is backward. And which is that deep reality, or ultimate reality, is inaccessible to conceptualization, which includes mathematics and scientific theories. And scientific theories are only relational, dealing with relational, contextual things, and therefore they're always awaiting a different context, and they can always be disproved. So, you know, it isn't that that's an absolute thing about former and future life, but in looking at the evidence, and people's memories, and your continuity, and the nature of your consciousness, and the fact that when you fall asleep and lose consciousness, you then go into a dream. And in a dream, you think you have eyes and ears again, you hear and see things, so your mind can reproduce a body, actually. And everyone here has had a dream. So you know that your mind produced one when your ordinary senses were asleep. You were produced a new set of senses, and you saw something in the dream, and you heard something, and you smelled something, etc. Rarely smell and touch, but you can smell and touch, right? So if your mind can do that every day, what's the big deal about then when you die, you don't have the body, but your mind can keep doing that? And actually, in the Book of the Dead, which very clearly analyzes this beautifully, which is, I mean, it's not, shouldn't be called the Book of the Dead, it's called the Book of Natural Liberation, by learning something in the between state. And in that it says, you become 9 times more intelligent the minute your mind is free of your brain. Because, you know, the brain has not just Alzheimer's, there's a lot of plaque and weird things in the brain, especially eating bad food in America, with the bad food industry and the bad agriculture, Monsanto-dominated agriculture industry, we eat a lot of bad food. And so the brain is like dampened down. So the mind gets free and you're immediately 9 times more intelligent. And they warn you, they say, when you that means you become immediately clairvoyant and telepathic. So they say, don't get mad at Uncle Joe at your funeral when you're floating around. And Uncle Joe is saying, oh, Bob died. I'm so sad. It's terrible. He was such a great guy. And then you're reading his mind and he's saying, good riddance. I'm sick of that guy. I don't listen to his jokes anymore. I need to raise him up my future life. That's great. I got rid of him. And then you get the ambivalence and the subliminal levels of people's minds you become totally aware of when you're a ghost, apparently in that brief period. And don't get upset, because it's bad for you to get upset. And everybody's ambivalent. People always have 2 or 3 things in their mind. And then when the lama or the priest or the rabbi, whoever it is like going droning on about whatever and thinking about their beard that they're going to get in a minute and how boring it is, don't be upset with them. They're still reciting the right verses. It's not that. Because you get much smarter. Your mind, without the brain, it lives in a hologram of subtle energy. And your mind is incredible. Your minds are all incredible. Why?
Why do you know? What's the proof that your mind is incredible? You picked a human embodiment. Do you think that's an obvious thing to do? If you're paranoid or you're greedy or something, why aren't you a crocodile or a rhinoceros? That's like it's like being born as a Sherman tank. That would be good. Who would come a little dinky human with weird fingers and running around? Why would you do that? Why would you choose to be human? Did you ever think about it? You think it's because we think it's such a normal thing? But a crocodile looks at human and they just see like too many bones and not that much meat. They'd much rather eat an antelope than a human. And so we're weird, you know? Look at us, we have these two eyes, it's all up here in our heads, can't see behind ourselves, fingers, they're very fragile, no armor on the skin, no fingernails, teeth are tiny unless we're vampires in a movie. I mean, we're like wimpy characters, but we know, we have more fun in bed. You wouldn't know that automatically when you're in the barrio. You wouldn't really know that. You might see some couple on Fifth Avenue or down the street here, like getting it on, you know, wonder what they were doing. And then you land in the womb by getting involved with it. So that means you have a certain, I mean, you already know that dead, you're a Buddhist. I can be a little like this. My wife is not here to scold me. And if you've ever seen those movies like about elephants getting it on, it's terrifying. Terrifying. She doesn't want to have anything to do with it. She runs away like this, knocking trees over as she goes. And he runs after her, and he's got a big hard arm, which she steps on as he goes. But he doesn't notice. He's so wound up. Finally, he catches her, and she's like, it's terrible. No foreplay, no fun, no caress, no kisses. Trunk is getting in the way. It's really awful. Humans, you know, we have these fingers. But it's not an obvious choice.
But we have tremendous brains and we can think it through. We can imagine all kinds of things, have fantasies. But it's an amazing form of life that you all are. You know? And if you stop to think that you are not just the product of a drop of sperm and an egg, you know, but you chose that form and you elaborated yourself to that form. And that's why in Buddhism they say, in Buddhist karma theory, which is a biological scientific theory, it's not a mystical thing, it's a biological theory. And you get to be human because as those other animals, you were more ethical. You made little choices. You restrained certain greeds and hostilities. And you sort of let the antelope go. You know, you didn't really fight that battle with Alawan. You were like more vulnerable and you were looking for more fun in a different way. And you weren't just like reveling and dominating your niche and just eating what was in front of you until you died. You were ethical. So ethicality is the cause of your human form. We are essentially ethical beings. That is Shakyamuni Buddha's secular ethics. Like His Holiness has elaborated a nice secular ethic for the materialist humans on the basis of the helplessness of the human infant, the generosity of the human female to lend her body to the baby to live there for nearly a year rent-free, which the males are not about to do. But the females are more advanced on the bodhisattva path, so they do. They accept a total stranger. You know, it could be Donald Trump being born there. You don't know. You have no idea. He could be in there and ready to go bankrupt at the age of three.
There's no guarantee. But then the human females allow that to happen. That's an amazing piece of generosity. Incredible. So that is the human form. It's based on ethicality. If you're beautiful, it's based on your having been patient with a bunch of annoying people instead of angry with them. Beauty comes from patience, right? Third paramita. And wealth, if you're wealthy, it's because you were generous in your previous life. They have marvelous rules. Those are rules about it. And there's all kinds of subtle ones, which I don't understand. Maybe you can explain to me. Apparently, if wherever you live is messy, you have a messy desk, messy office, it's because in previous life you gossiped too much. And I don't really know why. I can't figure that one out. There's all kinds of specific little things like that. Okay? So when you meditate on your preciousness, which if you do realistically, now realistic worldview, yeah, some of these people who try to pretend that Buddha didn't teach former and future life,
they are acting like, and Buddha therefore knew about materialism, and he was really just a modern materialist avant la lettre, so to speak. They, as I say, they're always pretending it's some sort of blind faith thing. But actually, it's an empirical thing that you have this form of future life. Your mind is energy.